take a minute to check your social battery. How's it doing? It's easy to ignore our needs and spread ourselves too thin. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/popcastpod today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/popcastpod.
Welcome to Popcast. Look, this week we're just going to jump right into it. R. Kelly was convicted of several charges this week in connection with more than two decades of an enterprise devoted to furnishing young women for sexual purposes. You know, we've talked about R. Kelly and we've talked about the case previously on Popcast, but I want to be really honest and say that the verdict hit me really, really hard. Following along over the last few weeks, reading about the testimony, reading about his relationship with Aaliyah has been just intensely challenging. I want to talk about it on this episode. You'll forgive me if I sound emotional. Also, you know, I'm recording this intro after speaking to the folks who were talked to. And I do want to say, and very rarely would I say this on podcast, but I want you guys to be mindful. There are some really, really difficult things being talked about. There's sexual assault, sexual abuse of a minor. These are things that we get into on this week's episode. And I know that that could be hard to listen to. And if for whatever reason you feel that you're not up for it, tap out. It's totally fine. We're just talking about stuff that's already been reported in the news. It's okay. We'll see you next week. We'll be here. But these conversations this week, first with Troy Clausen, who's one of our Metro reporters focused on criminal justice, and he did the lion's share of the coverage of the trial, which took place in Brooklyn federal court, along with Emily Palmer and Rebecca Davis O'Brien. Troy's going to call in to talk about what it was like to cover the trial and some of the particularities in how that case was presented and how the defense was presented. And then after that, Jim DeRogatis is going to call in. Jim's been on Popcast before. Jim, many of you will know, is the journalist who was the first, more than two decades ago, to bring early allegations against R. Kelly to light and has been doggedly covering it for the last two decades. And certainly Jim's work, along with Dream Hampton's documentary series, Surviving R. Kelly, radically reshaped the narrative around R. Kelly and popular culture, and I think set the table for what happened this week. So these conversations are conversations I've been wanting to have over the last few days, and these cases and victims still deserve to be in the spotlight. We have a guilty verdict, but it's important that we remember who's on the other side of that guilty verdict. So first, Troy Clausen's here. Troy covered the R. Kelly trial extensively, was there almost every day covering what was happening in the courtroom, and also spent a lot of time looking at how people outside the courtroom were reacting to what was going on inside. Troy, I appreciate you coming through and talking about this with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Sure. So let's start with the basics. People who've been paying attention understand that R. Kelly was put on trial previously for child pornography charges in Chicago about 12 years ago and was acquitted. This time around, he is convicted. Can you talk us through what he was convicted of and how these charges differed from last time?
The charges themselves were really, I think, a big reason why he was convicted. He was charged with racketeering and then violations of this, basically an anti-sex trafficking law. And what racketeering is, it's usually used to prosecute mob organizations, essentially saying that there was a criminal enterprise at the center of these crimes. And so R. Kelly's music business, prosecutors were saying, was essentially a double for the criminal enterprise he ran to recruit women and girls for sex for decades. And so that kind of allowed prosecutors to pull back evidence going back as far as 1991 in a regular case. If it was focused on one or two women and sexual abuse claims against him, they wouldn't have been allowed to do it. But because of the breadth of this charge, they were allowed to really go back and paint a picture of what they were saying this man was doing for essentially 30 years.
The use of the racketeering charge against R. Kelly, from what I understand, is a fairly novel application of racketeering. Is this something that prosecutors have done in a lot of similar sex crimes cases, or is it true that this is sort of made to fit R. Kelly's criminal enterprise?
It was pretty new. There was another case prosecuted in Brooklyn of the NXIVM sex cult that also was charged with racketeering, but that sex cult was much more structured. There was a clearer, you know, top of the organization and a stream down. And I think unlike that case, R. Kelly was also the only person indicted in Brooklyn. And so that was very unusual. And I think on one hand, a lot of observers thought it was a risky approach for prosecutors and that a jury might not understand how a music company and these people who were audio engineers and runners for him were contributing to a sex enterprise. But I think at the same time, it was just, it's almost just so hard to defend because you have so much evidence coming in.
And given the nature of the testimony from the people who aided and abetted what R. Kelly was doing, do you get the sense that those people entered into working for R. Kelly understanding that that's what they were going to do, or that it was R. Kelly essentially roping them in once they were employed by him under another pretext and saying, okay, you're my audio engineer, you're my runner, etc. This is also now part of your job.
Yeah, I think it was the latter. A lot of them who testified really did not know what they were getting into when they signed up to work with him. I remember there was one guy who testified. He was only worked for him for about a year, and he started as an intern. He had wanted to do a career in audio engineering or that field, and he was so shocked by the rules that he was supposed to enforce in the house. Instead of working on music itself, he was told to warn R. Kelly when his wife was coming so that R. Kelly could move any young women and girls from the hallways of his home so that his wife didn't see them. That was his job, as opposed to working on music. It was things like that that were so shocking for people. And I don't think they had any idea that that's what they were getting into. There was another guy who was tasked with picking up a lot of R. Kelly's girlfriends, driving them from either the train station or the airport to his home. And he was saying how it just felt like every time he went to the house, it was like entering the Twilight Zone, because he would be asked to put the mirrors of the car up so he wouldn't even look at the girls and women he was driving back and forth. It was just not at all what I think a lot of these people, especially the ones who only worked there for a short amount of time, thought they were getting into.
Were there things that jumped out to you as far as the testimony? I mean, obviously, the testimony was effective. R. Kelly is convicted. But on a more granular level, consistencies between whether it's victims or people who worked for R. Kelly, things that stuck with you that they were returned to over and over again over the course of the weeks that you were watching the testimony?
I think one thing, even not necessarily answering that question directly, but I was surprised by how much new information came out during the trial, just because there's been so much reporting and so much, especially in recent years, around the accusations against him. And I think a lot of us were not expecting to get so much deeper into all of these relationships and all of these accusations of abuse. And I think one similarity was just this system of rules that he had women and girls operate under, whether it was calling him daddy and addressing him as that when he entered a room, and whether it was he would take some of the women and girls to basketball games and they would be instructed to only look at men's feet who were playing, and sometimes they would have to face a wall instead of watching the court. And so it was just this strange system that he had them operate under. And then when they didn't follow those rules, it was the disturbing and just hard to describe punishments that they would face, whether it was these extremely harsh spankings. One woman said, I think she was about 4'11", and he beat her with a size 12 Nike sneaker at one point because she was texting a friend. It was just things like that that were so hard to listen to. And it wasn't just one woman who was saying it. It wasn't just two. It was over and over. They were saying that he made us follow these insane restrictions, and when we broke them, the punishments were just beyond belief.
One thing that I, just from being in the music industry or adjacent to it for many, many years, I feel like I certainly encounter people who work in, you know, junior level positions in or for very famous people who see themselves not as kind of independent agents, you know, with any agency. They just see themselves purely in service and probably couldn't imagine, even if the thing that they're seeing is wrong, couldn't imagine how to get out of that or find a way out of it. When the people who worked for R. Kelly were giving testimony, did you get the sense, number one, that there was moral conflict on the part of those people? And then getting a jury to understand that an enterprise like this, which is not a mob enterprise, not a the criminal enterprise that are usually thought of in these terms, actually functioned for the purpose of criminality, not simply as a side effect of a music enterprise.
I think a lot of the employees, not all of them, but several of them, expressed this kind of concern with what they were seeing themselves, whether it was through text messages with other employees and saying, I'm really put off by the way that he's treating this woman or this girl. I think there was also a lot of employees who described having to operate under the same type of restrictions that the women had to. There was one employee who said that he was punished, I think, in terms of a fine after he didn't get, you know, the right kind of tour guide that R. Kelly wanted. R. Kelly wanted a female tour guide, and he got a male tour guide for this event that they were going to. And then R. Kelly punished the employee for that. And so it was, I think if I was a juror listening to it, it would have been initially very hard to conceptualize how, you know, this music business and these employees operated for the purpose of getting R. Kelly people to have sex with. But as you continued to listen to it over 6 weeks, I think it just really came together in terms of how it wasn't just the women who were facing these kinds of insane environments, but it was the employees too. And they were all serving the bigger purpose of helping R. Kelly do what he did.
Observationally, watching the prosecution build that case, you also, from a reporting perspective, felt that they did an effective job, in essence, of starting from a you might not understand how this works perspective to, at the end of the trial, it being very, very clear how it worked.
Exactly. I mean, there were employees who testified just about how R. Kelly would snap and he would be completely fine in one moment, and then the smallest thing would happen, and then his entire behavior would shift. And they themselves would say they were scared about him and also what he would do to some of the women. And so I think as you continued to hear this kind of testimony, it was hard to ignore just the totality of it all, and hard to think that this wasn't a bigger enterprise here. It wasn't just one man who was operating alone. He really did use the people who he was around to help him do this.
One of the things that came up, especially in the coverage towards the end of the trial and after the verdict, was it seemed that R. Kelly's team didn't put up much of a defense, which is to say, all of the things you're describing that he did, that people testified to, it seems like they didn't push back against maybe the facts of those things or the statements of those things so much as try to undermine the credibility of some of the people who were giving that testimony. Is that an accurate reflection of how the defense team worked here?
That's definitely accurate. And I think that was part of the challenge with the jury finding any other verdict here, was that even for things like his marriage to Aaliyah, which came up for a lot of the trial, there was really no defense offered to suggest that the marriage didn't happen or that he wasn't aware of, you know, the things that were going on here, that he didn't know that the plan was to marry Aaliyah so that if she was pregnant, he would be safe in that situation. It was more so the defense lawyers trying to tackle the way that the jury was going to deliberate on that charge specifically in the language of it, as opposed to giving them an actual defense. And that was kind of what it was like for a lot of the trial. And I think when you have maybe one or two accusers, it's a lot easier to try to target their credibility and say that they're just liars or that they were super stalkers, as they said one of the women was. But when you have 11 different people taking the stand, I think that's just not the type of defense that he needed in this case. And I think that was a big reason why they ultimately convicted him on every count.
I think for me, following along over the weeks with the coverage that you and your colleagues were doing, certainly the hardest parts for me were the parts about Aaliyah. I feel like the level of detail about his relationship with Aaliyah is maybe the most level of detail in any context that we've had, you know, whether it's journalistically or in a court setting. Can you talk a little bit about how that relationship was discussed? How was it brought up and how was it folded into these larger racketeering charges?
Aaliyah really from the start was, I mean, she was the first woman in the charges themselves. And so she really was the start of the government's case. And I think it was so clear for, to me, it would have been clear if I was a juror, just how even from, you know, the early 1990s, one of the women who did take the stand testified that she saw R. Kelly having sex with Aaliyah when she was only 13 or 14 in the early 1990s. And then you have women in 2017 and 2018 saying that's when they met R. Kelly, and then he was doing the same thing to them, and that it escalated and that the behavior was even worse. And so I think that as somebody who had followed Aaliyah and followed her music and followed her involvement in this case, and then was hearing everything that people were testifying about, you know, I think that a big sentiment among people who I talked to, at least, was just if Aaliyah was protected better, if people cared more for her, then all of this would not have happened if they stopped him then. And so I think that was a big feeling just throughout the trial, that it was a start there, but it wasn't as graphic. It wasn't as disturbing necessarily in the same way that it was 20 years down the road, even though it was such jarring behavior to begin with.
And no one from Aaliyah's family, if I'm not mistaken, actually testified. It was only people who were in R. Kelly's orbit at that time.
Yeah, that's right.
For some of our younger listeners who did not live this as it was happening, Vibe magazine in the December 1994 issue published a copy of the marriage certificate, which says Aaliyah was 18, which she was not 18, but the marriage certificate between Aaliyah and R. Kelly. That marriage was obviously annulled, but this is December of 1994 that people knew that that happened. And here we are in 2021, finally arriving at some kind of justice, some kind of recompense for it. So it's just, you know, I want people to soak that in. I want people to absorb that. One thing that you did, in addition to covering the specifics of what's going on in the courtroom, is I feel like you were engaged with the kind of meta narrative about what was happening, both with R. Kelly supporters, also people online talking about the trial. Can you talk about these kind of like micro cottage scenes that bubbled up around the trial over the few weeks that it was going on?
One of the things that even from day one stood out to me was just, you know, I showed up around 6:30 thinking that it was going to be like Harvey Weinstein's trial, which I didn't cover, but I had seen the photos and heard about it and seen how crazy the media environment was around that then. And, you know, I showed up at 6:30 and I was one of the first people in line. And then people just started trickling in after that on day one of openings. And throughout the trial, there just wasn't a lot of media coverage, particularly from white or media outlets, that was surprising to me. And I think that was something that, you know, was a theme throughout the trial, even towards its end. And you see the people who were coming out at the trial, there wasn't a ton of supporters or a huge base of fans, but there was a steady group of 10 or 11 fans, mainly Black fans, who were coming out, and some of them
And they came every day.
Yeah, most of them came every day. And it was sometimes a revolving group, but it was, you know, the same 11 or so women who some of them had flown out from Illinois and then went back during the middle of the trial. But it was just striking to me to see who was paying attention to this and who wasn't. And I think that, as you mentioned, you know, extended online, you know, there was so much attention around this trial, you know, on social media, whether it was through YouTube videos that people would do where they were just reading through the transcripts, or in TikTok videos where people were breaking down some of the complex legal underpinnings of the case. There was just so much around it, and it wasn't even just the support. It was just the interest in this moment in particular.
This past week, we've also seen a lot of action in the Britney Spears conservatorship case, and that's another example of a rather complex legal situation that has this very fervent and, in some cases, detail, micro detail obsessed online following, people, you know, poring over filings and things of that nature. Investigative reporting is something that you do for a living, but it's also something that a lot of people feel online, that they do it in a crowdsourced way. What is it like for you as someone who's there every day reading the filings, observing the testimony? Do you feel, I don't know if kinship is the right word, but when you see these kinds of YouTube channels going over all the filings, do you feel enthused or hopeful about that? Or do you feel like it's a little bit muddying because it's not, maybe not as formal as traditional journalism work?
No, I thought it was extremely interesting to see, especially some of the YouTube channels around this that were getting the biggest audiences, in how, honestly, they were getting more views on their videos than we were getting readership for our stories. And so I think it was just another way that maybe an audience who is following this trial, it prefers to listen to someone break down the testimony and the way that these people were and going through the evidence and delving into this case in a different way from a story from the New York Times. And so I wouldn't say it was, you know, this kinship or anything like that, but I thought it was just valuable to see that so many people, even if it wasn't in the same way that I had expected, were engaging with this and also found meaning in a trial that put Black women at center stage.
We talked a little bit before we started recording, and you mentioned a minute ago about how many, or perhaps how few, news outlets were covering this, certainly not at the level that we were covering it. How much of that's about race, even in 2021, even, you know, post 2020, even post Me Too? How much of that is still in your mind about this kind of systemic lack of interest or overlooking of Black women and young Black women?
I think it's very linked to that. I think it's both probably about the fact that all of the accusers in this case were Black, most of them being Black women. I think it has a lot to do with the fact that R. Kelly also holds a different importance to Black communities than he does to white communities. You know, almost all of the white jurors, prospective jurors who came in to talk to the judge about whether or not they would serve on this jury, most of them didn't know anything about R. Kelly beyond I Believe I Can Fly. Almost all of the prospective Black jurors who came in did. And I think that is a major part of it too, and just who R. Kelly was important to and who these accusers are important to. And I think it's kind of the combination of that that equals having not a ton of media interest more broadly in this case, as you might have seen for other huge Me Too trials.
Even hearing you say it and all, everything you're saying makes a kind of a logical sense, but I would have thought in the wake of surviving R. Kelly, and certainly in the wake of last summer, that there would have been some kind of reckoning at news organizations, you know, the same news organizations who I'm sure in many cases were responsible for covering R. Kelly with some fervor during his big run. It's dispiriting to hear.
Yeah, I think part of it too was, you know, talking to other reporters there, I think the ones, even the ones who were covering it regularly, were surprised by how little interest their stories were getting from the audience online, from readers. And I think that was part of it as well, as just, I don't think it was solely the fact that people weren't interested in covering it, but also the fact that what they did cover just wasn't picking up steam in the way that they might have expected with everything you just talked about and the reckoning around Me Too and surviving R. Kelly and all of this interest that was around him a few years ago. It kind of disappeared right now in this current moment.
Do you get a sense that there's going to be an appeal in the case?
Yes, I think that his defense lawyers have all but made it clear that that is the route that they plan on going through. And, you know, even as he has these other cases looming, I think that they are definitely appealing this.
There's at least one other federal case and there's a couple state cases, correct?
Yeah. So he is also, the Chicago federal trial against him is expected to continue. Aside from that trial, there are also state sex crime charges against him in Illinois and in Minnesota. And I am not sure what the status of those are. I was talking to Kim Fox, who's the top prosecutor in Chicago, who is leading those state cases against him in Illinois. And she was saying it is all just pending this Chicago federal trial. And I think after that trial is over, then some of these smaller, but still such, these cases that still carry so much weight will continue after that.
the nature of the state cases are not racketeering cases. They are for individual acts.
None of the other cases against him are built in this same way. They all center around individual women and individual accusations.
Well, Troy, I appreciate, first of all, I appreciate you talking this through with us. I also appreciate just your diligence in staying on this over the last few weeks, especially because we're going to look back on this, I think, and be grateful for the depth of coverage. So thanks, man. I appreciate you.
Thanks for having me on.
We'll be back in just a minute with Jim DeRogatis.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
So for part two of this week's episode about the resolution of the R. Kelly trial, we're lucky enough that Jim DeRogatis is calling in. Jim has been on podcast before talking about this. Jim is also the journalist who for more than two decades has been pursuing leads and stories, sometimes at his own personal peril, about the sex crime enterprise R. Kelly built around himself, and which we are finally this week seeing some kind of criminal justice for. Jim, as always, I'm really happy to have you here. Thanks for calling.
Sure. You bet, John.
I think let's maybe start with the emotional, which is, you know, this is a major, major shift in the narrative around R. Kelly publicly. He's finally being held to account for these crimes on an emotional level. Like, how did this verdict hit you?
Well, I'm glad never to have to use allegedly again.
Yeah.
It never seemed like I should have from the first time I sat with a young woman who showed me the scars on her wrists where she tried to kill herself. And back then the Cook County State's Attorney's Office in Illinois was not interested whatsoever in pursuing criminal charges against this powerful and beloved figure on behalf of a 15-year-old black girl. Emotionally, I know journalists love to ask other journalists, how did it feel? I mean, my focus was on how the women felt always. You know, those that I heard from this week were glad that he was finally being held to account for these crimes that stretch back to 1991, 30 years. And they also felt it was too little, too late. I was in the middle of teaching my two giant 150 student each lecture classes in music and media in Chicago at Columbia College. The verdict comes in by blowing up my phone in my 45-minute break. Thankfully, it was gospel day. And when I apologized to the second class that I was going to be a little distracted, I had written two pre-writes of the column. I was doing a weekly column for the New Yorker on the trial, and I had written there's only two possible stories, really, right? And thankfully, the other one will never be read. So I'm dealing with fact checkers and my phone exploding and the always diligent editing process of the New Yorker. And I told my class about this verdict, and they gave it a standing ovation. And You know, these are 18-year-olds who were not yet born when Ignition Remix was released. Their entire life, Kelly has been an unconvicted sexual predator, now convicted. It was powerful, I'll tell you, brother. I never needed a little Mahalia Jackson more.
I'm intrigued, actually, talking about the generational understanding of R. Kelly. Do you find that with students of that age, that there is no ambiguity, that they do fundamentally understand, even before this week's verdict, that even if they did listen to an R. Kelly song, they're not listening to it without also understanding the gravity and scope of everything else around him?
Yeah, absolutely. I think since my friend Dream Hampton and Surviving R. Kelly in January 2019, I don't think there is anyone cognizant in 2019 who doesn't treat him as guilty for his entire career. I think the last generation, John, I think we talked about this last time, is the unforgivable sin of Pitchfork, Bonnaroo, and Coachella booking Kelly in 2013 and somehow treating that as kitsch. I mean, I thought by 2013 that a mere 13 years of evidence was more than enough. But then I thought we had compiled definitive evidence on December 21, 2000 in the Sun-Times with the first story.
You know, I was talking to Troy in the previous segment, Vibe magazine, December 1994, publishing the marriage certificate between R. Kelly and Aaliyah.
Yeah, but there was no context when Vibe published that. And I've talked to Danielle Smith since, you know, and Vibe, especially Danielle, came to regret that it was treated as rumor, gossip, weirdness in the pop culture world. And John, you and I cover weirdness in pop culture as our jobs. I don't think people realize, but I mean, you know, you have to take a breath and look at this historically. If two of the biggest stars in popular music today got married and one was 27 and the other was 15, I do not think it could ever be swept under the rug.
Absolutely
the way, not. You know, it's unconscionable. So I'll tell you the other points where I got emotional. I mean, there were several, you know, when quite clearly Aaliyah's uncle, Barry Hankerson, erected a three-story billboard just across the East River, spitting distance from Cadman Plaza and the federal courthouse of, you know, saying Aaliyah is coming. I have confirmed that was absolutely intentional, the placement there.
Oh, wow.
If it could have been next door to the courthouse, but that was the one that was available. You know, it was interesting. Aaliyah was Jane Doe number one, but there was not a specific crime tied to her. And that was part of the challenge. My kudos and endless appreciation to Troy and Emily, who covered it for the Times. I mean, this case was complicated. Even when you saw the jury verdict sheet, it was impossible to understand. You and I, as students of pop music history, this is now officially the biggest predator in the history of popular music. You know, there's no two ways about it. There's nobody worse. It's historic. And of course, it was an historic victory for women of color. You know, this is the first prosecution and conviction of a serial sexual predator whose victims were almost all women of color.
Can you talk a little bit about the way this case was built that allowed it to be successful? Obviously, some of the success is baked into the broader conversation around Me Too, and also what Dream did with the documentary and what you did. So obviously, part of that is that context, but also the nature of the charges this time were different than the nature of charges 13 years ago. Can you talk about what allowed this case to succeed where the previous one had not succeeded?
Well, you know, there is still a second federal indictment in the Northern District of Illinois that centers on the 2008 trial. And we now know the 2008 trial resulted in acquittal because Kelly bribed many witnesses and victims to not testify and physically threatened others. As an interesting footnote, that trial is still going on. I don't think it was Me Too. I don't think it was anything else other than a really smart gambit that I will confess to you I thought was going to fail until a week before the verdict, when I talked to literally the man who wrote the textbook on RICO, a law professor in Minnesota. So the racketeering law, he said, chiding me as a thick-headed guy from Jersey, right? Because here's the question I ask, and I always get away with this, as you do, John. I said, you know, you have indicted Kelly as the godfather. Where are Tessio and Clemenza? And he said, look, RICO in popular culture versus RICO on the law books. And he educates and joins the teams of many lawyers, criminal lawyers, expert lawyers who don't understand RICO. The enterprise itself saying, hey, John, you and I are in a mob, right? That doesn't carry any criminal penalty. Under RICO, you have to name specific predicate acts. These terms you learn, that enumerate the crimes. But RICO is a really big umbrella that you can get all sorts of people and all sorts of crimes and years of evidence, not specifically timed to crimes because maybe the statute of limitations expired, Aaliyah, or other factors, right? So they were able to lay out this extraordinary case of 30 years of criminal behavior and mention all sorts of his enablers, including two who were indicted in Chicago. They were entering these guys' pictures into evidence and showing them to witnesses. So the jury heard lots of names, Daryl McDavid and June Brown and Junebug, and right? But the government didn't have to worry about proving crimes by any of those people beyond a reasonable doubt. They kept the spotlight firmly on Kelly, but were able to build a bigger case because of RICO. Hey, in the end, they were 100% successful. There is no ambiguity. He's guilty on every charge and facing life in prison at the far end of the spectrum. So it was a perhaps daring strategy, but it worked. It was a smart strategy. I was a little worried for a bit there. I think the victim's testimony was so compelling. Thank you, New York Times, for joining with the New Yorker and the Chicago Tribune to buy those transcripts. They were coming often a week late, but I have yet to read a single word that anyone I interviewed among the victims who testified said that was different than what they told me years ago from what they said on the stand.
Do you have any anxiety about this getting undone on appeal?
No, because there's the second federal case, and then there's a state of Illinois case, and then there's a state of Minnesota case. But, you know, the other big reason, bigger than Me Too again, was Kelly is broke. And the defense team he had was absolutely bargain basement. In her opening statement, Nicole Blank Becker said, the government's going to tell you a mess of lies, and you're not going to be able to make sense of any of them, and you're going to have to find Mr. Kelly guilty. And then she paused and corrected herself. I mean, not guilty. Devereaux Canik was asking all of the victims whether they twerked in Kelly's presence and comparing Kelly to Martin Luther King Jr.
I saw that,
in his
closing.
Oh, my God. Where did they find this bozo? There's a good piece in the Times about the failures of the defense. They're still victim blaming as if it was 1950, when the real defense would have been, what the hell are you talking about? Criminal enterprise. We're talking about one guy who sings.
You and I are both closer to the music business than a lot of other people who maybe covered the trial from a criminal perspective. Do you think that this verdict will make people who work in the music business think more critically, not simply about the kind of ecosystem around sex and whether it's recruiting in a formal or informal way women for sex, but also just to apply a filter of moral valence to the everyday behaviors?
Are you asking me whether the music industry is going to develop a moral conscience?
I'm just here to pose the question and think about the hard
stuff.
It's
a great question, and I wish the answer was yes. But we both know that nothing matters more in music than the bottom line, the dollar, the cash machine. Thou shalt not derail the gravy train. You know, on Sound Opinions, if you listen to only two podcasts, make it John's and Sound Opinions, we blew up the show at the last minute after the verdict, and Dream Hampton and I talked for an hour. And we needed some catharsis, the two of us. We have not been in the same city. We've talked many times since 2019. But, you know, we said we got to have this cocktail. And she said, I think we should both fly to the Cayman Islands and knock on the door of Mr. Clive Calder. Of the, you know, now here is a South African gent who in the new wave era in London starts a record label, Jive. In the 90s, there is no more powerful record company. That's not hyperbole. On top of Kelly selling 100 million records, he is the label that brings us Britney Spears. Look how well that poor woman's life turned out. And NSYNC. And look at those boys being victimized by Lou Pearlman. Okay. Jive was named in the first lawsuit, you know, filed by Tiffany Hawkins, and sued for $10 million. She only got a crummy $250,000, of which the lawyer kept a third. But, John, if you are sued for $10 million, you know about it. The only one to ever get Clive Calder and Barry Weiss, who was the number two at the label, on the record was Jeff Edgers in a piece in the Washington Post. You know, and they said, hey, we were running a record company. What were we supposed to do? What were you supposed to do? You were providing money to pay off young girls. You were providing money for him to have lawyers who got him off the hook. It's unconscionable. And I think it would happen next week. And above and beyond that, people who should know better, like my old friend Kanye West, you know, he trots out Marilyn Manson. And Steve Appleford, a music journalist I respect and have edited, gives a career reclamation in a fawning, endless profile in Los Angeles Magazine to Ryan Adams, who your newspaper took on. It's not changing. It's certainly not changing fast enough, maybe by little tiny increments. And I am haunted by this question. We all know that in rock and roll, in hip hop, in all of popular music, the bad boy pose is part and parcel of the allure of the music. The outsider, the lawbreaker, the renegade, right? And, you know, to what extent did Kelly succeed despite what he was doing? Forget despite, because of it. Because of it.
You know, these are questions that have to be asked, not just of people who work in the music business, but people who consume music, and people need to look in the mirror and say, what is it that's inside of me somewhere that chooses to be, wants to be, needs to be drawn to something like this and to a person who behaves this way? And that's part of the collective healing that I think that, you know, in terms of like eradicating this from the music business, that's part of the collective healing that I think that everybody has a role in, not simply the legal system, not simply the music industry, and not simply the individual moral actors who are at the center of this.
Yeah, you know, it's true, but I think it's particularly pronounced in this beloved art form that the two of us cover. I certainly am anti-censorship to the core of my being. I don't know what the right answer is regarding Kelly's vast catalog, but I know that that discussion has to be had. And, you know, if you can listen to the super sexualized music anymore, it's different. Step in the Name of Love or I Believe I Can Fly. But it has now been laid bare in a court of law that, you know, Bump and Grind, Ignition Remix, Stick Your Key in My Ignition, you know, Trapped in the Closet. We know what he was talking about.
And to be honest, like, I can't listen to any R. Kelly. Like, it doesn't matter to me if it's the, if it's hypersexual, it doesn't matter if it's hyper inspirational. You know, when people were having that conversation about removing problematic artists' catalogs from Spotify and from streaming services, you know, 2-3 years ago, when that was something that Spotify was being asked to take a stand on and then momentarily did, I always felt it would be very hard to litigate that. But what ends up happening is in the hearts and minds and guts of listeners, people will make those choices. And like, yes, are millions of people still streaming R. Kelly's music? It certainly seems that they are. Is it fewer than would be otherwise? I certainly believe so. And I think you're going to see that decline month over month, year over year, as people don't want to be personally implicated. They don't want to feel that they're part of this thing that has been deemed a criminal enterprise, even in the most passive way.
I don't think that's enough. I ended my interview with Dream. I got derailed in telling that story. We've been talking about a cocktail forever. She said, let's fly to the Cayman Islands. I said, that's great. And we ring Clive Calder's doorbell and we ask him to start a fund to give all the money he made from R. Kelly to the victims. And the same should be true of Barry Weiss, and the same should be true of Spotify, and Apple has the music, and Amazon is selling it. You know, where should that money go? You know, so, I mean, you know, of course, Dream, you know, a great student and philosopher and journalist from the African-American perspective is thinking retribution. And it's like, yeah, goddamn, that's the answer. That's the answer. And let's go to Live Nation and ask them for their share of the tickets they sold. And let's go to everybody else. Pitchfork apologized for booking R. Kelly. But how about coming up with, you know, now that they're owned by Condé Nast, a big chunk of the money they made that year? You know, we're in this damn capitalist society and money's the only thing people understand, right?
Well, if any of people who work at those institutions are listening, and I think and suspect that some of them are, maybe that's a conversation they want to start having. We're certainly here for that conversation.
There's an incredible organization of brave young Black women in Chicago called The Long Walk Home that work with rape victims. I would recommend that they assuage their guilty consciences by giving some of that filthy lucre to a group like that.
Jim, appreciate you calling in and appreciate just you being you for the last 20 years.
It's kind of like you live long enough, John, and the guy who was always just an annoying jerk suddenly becomes like, oh, we should have maybe listened to him.
I sometimes hope that for myself, too. So I hear that. Thanks for calling in. I appreciate it. And just big picture, thank you to Jim. Thank you to Dream Hampton. Thank you to Troy and Emily for covering the trial. And thanks to everybody who continued to keep eyes and ears on this over the last couple decades. It has not gone unnoticed. We'll be back next week.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's Jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.